over the years in researching Stoicism, I've seen great Stoic educators get asked the question, what is your Stoic daily routine? Or how do you practice Stoicism? What kinds of thoughts or meditations or journaling prompts do you use on a daily basis to live wisely with virtue? And sometimes I hear the surprising response of, oh, I actually don't practice Stoicism. I know a lot about it, but I don't practice it. Or you see individuals who claim to be a practicing Stoic, but don't really present any evidence that they are practicing it. Maybe they say that occasionally they have certain Stoic thoughts, you know, like one or two a week. But the question is that Stoicism? And is there a difference between learning about Stoicism in a textbook versus actually practicing it, training with it like a skill? And this is something that I wanted to ask Donald Robertson, author of Stoicism and the Art of Happiness, Verissimus, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, and other amazing Stoic works. So check out the question that I asked Donald here and his following response. I think you'll find a lot of wisdom and insight in what he says about this important topic. Do you think that there's a difference between someone who just knows a lot about Stoicism from someone who is a practicing Stoic? You know, because, you know, sometimes I've seen speakers and they studied Stoicism, they give a lecture on it, but then someone asks them, like, do you practice it? And they're like, oh, actually, no, not at all. What's going on there?
I think maybe I mentioned that when I first started, my first degree is in philosophy. And so when I first got into Stoicism, I was kind of reading books by academic philosophers. And gosh, this seems really weird to me now, right? Because the culture over the space of 20 years has completely changed in relation to Stoicism. So there was a time where it was mainly academic philosophers that wrote about it. And they would happily say that they just read the books and they never actually occurred to them to... I've spoken to professors, like senior academics, who say, it never occurred to me that anyone would try and actually put this into practice, which seems really weird, given that the Stoics go on and on and on about how you're supposed to put it into practice, and that, you know, Epictetus in particular rants at his students about how they're not to be pen and paper philosophers and that they should actually be living the philosophy, otherwise what's the point of it? So how is it that someone could spend a career studying this and then think, oh, I didn't think he meant that literally. Also, I don't know, it seems really weird. But now, I think it's become fairly common for, like, most academics now, I think, actually realize that that's absurd. It's taken them 20 or 30 years, but they're now going, oh, there are loads of people that actually put this into practice. So it does seem a bit ridiculous to say that you would just read it and not do it. So sometimes people do still say that, but it's become less common. And yeah, like, you know, on the one hand, everybody that's into Stoicism pretty much now is trying to put it into practice. On the other hand, I'm also kind of surprised. I think most people don't know how to put it into practice. So the Stoics have many psychological exercises and practices that they use. And so I see there are like thousands and thousands and thousands of people around the world trying to follow Stoicism. But if you ask most of them what they actually do, they're not really using the contemplative exercises or the techniques that much, which still kind of surprises me. I think it's kind of like they want to put it into practice, but they're still not really sure exactly how to do it. There's loads of resources explaining it. You know, Stoic Week, we run every year, and like 20,000 people or something, I think, have done that so far. And it tries to really guide people through and explain, like, this is stuff that you would do every day if you were a Stoic. You'd do the view from above and contemplate your own mortality and ask yourself these questions. And, like, there's, you know, like a bunch of specific things that Stoics would do to try and train their minds. I think that's the next stage in the evolution of Stoicism, is that people start to kind of really become a lot bit more kind of structured in the way that they put it into practice, right, and they're more aware of the actual exercises that they could be doing.
Yeah, for sure. I see that as something that is kind of missing myself, and that, like, for some, I'm a constant, like, experimenter, and I'm always trying to kind of do things myself, and I'm definitely the type of person to like sit down and try and write like a routine and use your view from above meditation. But some people, they just have a few books and they kind of get stuck on
Marcus
it.
Marcus Aurelius says he does a view from above every day. And like, I thought about this a lot. Like the first book I wrote in Stoicism, The Philosophy of CBT, I tried to list all the psychological techniques. And there are about 18 like different distinct psychological techniques that they describe repeatedly. There's like a whole toolbox of different techniques. But I mean, that's too much, right? So the problem is there's too many. So I would say you could choose different ones to focus on. Like I would say cognitive distancing in a sense is the most fundamental. But I my experience has taught me that probably the view from above is the thing that people kind of find easiest to do on a regular basis. And I think like for most people who are like not really sure how to follow Stoicism more systematically, what it says, just maybe do the view from above every day, or like every few days, like, because that alone actually is going to help you make a lot more sense out of a lot of the other aspects of the philosophy. I mean, like, that's probably a kind of good enough starting place for the majority of people. It's fairly, I mean, you can even just listen to a recording, right? Or, you know, pretty quickly, once you've got the idea of it, you could just shut your eyes and think about the concept for a couple of minutes. Like every day, you know, it gets actually much, much easier with a week or two of practice, like most of these psychological techniques. So I think that's kind of, maybe we've overcomplicated it for people by kind of giving them too many options. We should just say, just do that. Just do that, buddy. You know, like, just to kind of get started. Like, you can't go too far wrong.
Yeah. Are you familiar, I presume you are, with the John Vivekey video, View from Above, that he used your meditation as like the source for that?
I didn't know that. But I've met John Vivekey, and he spoke at our conference in Toronto. He's a psychologist at the University of Toronto, and I did the View from Above kind of guided meditation at the is it the conference recording that you're talking about, or is it in another video?
He's got a video that is like titled The View from Above. So he's talking specifically about that. And then I think he links to your meditation. If you haven't seen that, you can check it out.
He completely, like, he understands the psychological significance of it. I mean, it's a really weird thing. When I first started talking to therapists about Stoicism, the thing they were most interested in was The View from Above. And I guess it's kind of hard to explain exactly why, but the only way I can put it very simply like this, that the view from above it is really easy to do, and it clearly has a psychological effect. So psychologists love that because they think that there's got to be, it looks like it, the sort of thing that should have some kind of therapeutic effect. It looks like a no-brainer. To put it very crudely, that you should be able to do some kind of outcome study on this. Like, out of everything in Stoicism, you think, this is it. All we have to do is make a recording of this, get a bunch of people to listen to it, compare it to a control group. Like, this is like, this should be a piece of cake, like, to do an outcome study. So I think whenever you're talking to, like, CBT practitioners or psychologists, they immediately kind of get interested in it and their eyes light up. And also they're kind of thinking, how come we haven't already done research on this? Like, so I don't think it'll be that long before we see there already are studies being done on it. It's funny because a lot of therapists and philosophers will say, like Freudians for ages used to say, oh, you can't research this stuff. It's too, you know, like they'd be talking about Freudian analysis or Jungian analysis and they'd be like, it's too subtle. It's too subtle. It can never be measured. It can never be quantified. It's like, you know, good on you, buddy. Like, you know, but you, sometimes you kind of need to know whether something works or not. And some things are cool and philosophical and also stupidly easy to test. Like, the view from above is like a godsend to psychologists because they're like, clearly, if you visualize things from an elevated perspective and stuff like that, that's a learnable skill. And it clearly changes your perspective dramatically. So it's got to do something. I mean, either it's going to kill you or it's going to cure you, right? It's going to do something. So psychologists are like, you know, it's one or the other. Like, let's start testing it and find out which it is. So it really appeals to them. I mean, luckily, like, anecdotally, and from what little evidence we have, it looks like it's beneficial, like the Stoics thought it was. But, you know, I guess almost more importantly, it's easily testable. So weirdly, it's not part of CBT, really. Like, you know, there are some kind of indirect or, like, things. But one of the things that surprised me when I was talking to therapists, they'd say, no, you're right. Like, many of the things we do in Stoicism are identical to or very similar to things that we would do in broadly CBT-based therapy. But there's not a common technique that we use in therapy that closely resembles a view from above. It's like a gap in the market. Like, you know, there's an obvious gap there in terms of the repertoire of modern therapy. And all the therapists I know are like, how come we're not doing this? Like, you know, it's definitely got to be worth a try. So I guess it's an exciting concept for psychologists and psychotherapists.
So final question for you. So if Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, the ancient Stoics were transported into the current era, if they were just to look at the kind of culture of modern Stoicism, not any particular author or work, but just the kind of the overall landscape of modern Stoicism, do you think there would be any things that they would kind of disagree with or think that people are doing well or would want to inject more of something else into it? Like, how do you think they would interpret it?
I think they'd want there to be more graphic novels.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know. I've no idea. That would blow their minds, I think. They'd be like, what is this thing? I'm not sure what they would make of that. Although, weirdly, as an aside, one of our main historical sources for Marcus Aurelius is a thing called the Aurelian Column, which is a huge column that has this circular frieze that spirals around it. And that's sequential art. It's like a precursor of modern graphics. So they are. Like, you know, actually, that kind of exists in Marcus Aurelius' time. They would look at us. That's a big question and a really interesting question. I think that there are a lot of things about modern society they would find kind of weird. I think they would think that we're very sheltered from our own sense of mortality. It's hard to know what to pick on because there's so many things. But yeah. I think one of them is that they would probably say, you guys don't really live sheltered lives. Like, you know, you don't really see people die. You don't look after your dying relatives. You're not seeing infant mortality like we did. You're not serving in the military like at close quarters like we did. You know, like you guys are really sheltered from anything that reminds you of your own mortality. And I think that in that respect, they would think that we were missing something, that we were naive in that regard. They thought their contemporaries were naive in terms of burying their head in the sand about their own mortality. They're going to think we are far worse in that respect, for the most part, I believe. They would also think that we're stupid, and they'd be right, because for a reason that's, you know, this idea of the Dunning-Kruger effect, like that in some areas, people don't know how stupid they are or how little they know because they don't have the technical knowledge to be able to appraise their lack of knowledge. So like someone who doesn't know how to do basic arithmetic is not even going to understand when someone explains to them how they're getting sums wrong, because they're like, I don't even understand the explanation. You know, I don't know how to do addition. Like, I'm just guessing the numbers, and someone tries to explain how they're getting these calculations wrong, but like not even the explanation's gone over my head. So they don't even know how little they know, and it's hard to explain to them sometimes. Like, so we know in modern society, compared to an educated Greek or Roman, where most of us are woefully ignorant in about rhetoric and logic, and like they would think we're kind of thick as two short bricks in that regard. Frankly, they'd be like, "Do you guys not understand common informal fallacy? Like, you guys keep on the." They'd look at us on the internet and they'd think, "You guys are making the same childlike errors of reasoning over and over again." Like, you know, they think our political debates are infantile. I mean, that these things happened in their time, but educated people were more cognizant of what was going on. So, like, ad hominem fallacies, overgeneralization, causal fallacies, modal fallacies, like, you know, they knew how to reason, like, technically. In the same way that we know how to do a division and multiplication and stuff, that they knew how to use logic. And they'd look at, like, what we were doing and think, you guys are, like, don't even understand, like, how to think straight. Like, it's shocking. They'd look at, they'd have a field day with podcasts. Like, I think Marcus Aurelius, Joe Rogan did the podcast recently about how he loves Marcus Aurelius. I think if Marcus Aurelius watched Joe Rogan's podcast, it would make him weep. Like, the level of stupidity on show and, like, you know, crass ignorance and just, like, absurd, like, illogical, like, reasoning on display and constant head banging against the wall abuse of the causal fallacy when talking about things like research and COVID vaccines. I mean, Marcus Aurelius doesn't even know anything about scientific, like, but he'd understand the sort of shoddy reasoning that's on display immediately, I think. Ancient philosophy, Epictetus, like, ancient philosophers studied dialectic. They trained, Marcus spent decades training in rhetoric. And so when you train in rhetoric, you understand, you learn how to manipulate people. Yeah. And rhetoric and logic are two sides of the same coin. So you when you learn logic, you learn how to spot logical fallacies. And when you learn rhetoric, you learn how to exploit logical fallacies. Like, you know, it's the two sides of the same thing, right? And Marcus had trained for decades with the leading thinkers of his era in logic and rhetoric. So these guys are way ahead of us. Like, in terms of, you know, it's funny because we normally think of progress in the sciences.
Yeah.
But, wait, I mean, even if you're a philosophy graduate, you know, you do, like, you know, a few classes in logic and you employ Socratic method and philosophical reasoning kind of, like, for a few years and seminars and stuff like that. Nothing like the level at which ancient Greek and Roman philosophers were doing it on a daily basis for decades of their lives. They would wipe the floor with us easily in that regard. And they would watch Joe Rogan and they would watch CNN and Fox and all the other garbage that we consume and think that it was amazing that we've taken such a step backwards and we're now reasoning like, you know, we like idiots. Like they think we'd regressed compared to them, and had become imbeciles. Like, that's my honest opinion. Like, I really, honestly, if Marcus was here today, he'd look at the internet and think, "How did we end up being so stupid? Like, how come these people can't spot, like, you know, the use of sophistry? Like, has nobody taught them, like, you know, how to spot overgeneralizations and arguments and black and white reasoning and, you know, all these kind of things? The internet's full of people, like, using the ad hominem argument and stuff, like, politicians do it all the time. Like, but Greeks and Romans would just laugh at that. Like, but we've regressed back into, like, being duped by it. So logic needs to come to our rescue. Like, you know, that really is one of the main weaknesses in modern society. You know, I think everyone's aware that political discourse is like a car crash, right? It's got a dumpster fire, right? On social media. I think it's fair to say, American political and Britain, most countries, not maybe not everywhere in the world, but like political debate is farcical. I think like the ancient Greeks and Romans would have a lot to say about that. I mean, they had to deal with these things, but they understood what was going on around them. Like, they weren't as gullible as they think we're gullible by comparison. I'm sure of that.
Wow. Yeah. I feel both dumb, but also very inspired to go and start looking at logic and rhetoric. So,
The basic thing, the starting point, I think, it's almost like logic, I think, is taught a little bit back to front. Like, we just need to learn about common fallacies. Like, most people actually are start looking at philosophy, learn about things like the ad hominem fallacy. Yeah. So you see in debates, people will go, somebody will forward an argument and they'll go, well, that guy's a Nazi. Like, and you'll think, well, hang on a minute. That doesn't mean to say that the thing that he said, like, whether or not that's true. Or nowadays, it's like that politician's like a paedophilia or something like that, or like whatever. Like, so insults are thrown, accusations are thrown at people that detract from the content of what they're actually saying. Like, and people will reject an argument based on who said it, rather than whether or not the thing that they say is logical or there's evidence for it. Like, so that's the ad hominem fallacy, right? It's all over the internet, like, on a hour-by-hour basis. Like, so I think, you know, just kind of spotting stuff like that is more important. Like, the help, by the way, medical, like any cognitive therapist, it's evidence-based practice. We have to read research studies. Like, the media exploit a fallacy called the causal fallacy every day in reporting medical research. And, you know, like that, they confuse correlation and causation. Like, it's their favorite thing to do over and over and over again. As an aside, I'd say to people, look up causal fallacies and look at the fallacy of confusing correlation and causation. It's fairly simple. And then you'll see, that a lot of the health reporting, the reporting of medical research is garbage. And it's just distorting and exploiting information in order to freak people out. It's a big problem for public health in our society. But I don't think the ancient Stoics would have understood that, because this is a problem more prominent in relation to modern scientific research. But it's a big problem in our society. We're being fed not just misinformation, but like these guys are saying 1 + 1 = 3 or something. Like, the stuff they're saying is just completely nonsensical. But it happens over and over and over. Joe Rogan has a career built out of doing this, pretty much. He's not the only one. He's picking on him because he's the biggest one, right? But, there's loads of other people. The media's full of it. Tabloid newspapers have been doing this for decades on a huge scale. But it's time that people became more educated about basic misinformation and health research, I think. So that's one of them, that people should arm themselves. So the Stoics thought we have to study logic in order to defend ourselves against misinformation. Like, that was their argument for it. The Cynics didn't study logic. And then the Stoics' argument is, no, well, the thing is, if you don't study logic, then you're vulnerable to people manipulating you with, rhetoric. You'll fall prey to sophists then. So at the very least, you need to understand enough to protect yourself. That's really part of what ancient philosophy was about, but that aspect of it is kind of almost defunct now.
I love that frame. Logic is sort of psychological self-defense. That's it's a really powerful one. I hope that you enjoyed that, took some value from it. Couple of quick things. If you can leave a rating for the podcast wherever you're listening to it, that really helps new people find it. And I also love reading reviews, so let me know what you think about it. And if you want to go further and get access to all of my premium meditations and audio courses, ask me anythings, workshops, etc., consider subscribing to Stoic Handbook Premium with a free trial, either directly within Apple Podcasts or over at stoichandbook.supercast.com. It's the same thing, just two different ways to access it. And I'll see you back here for the next episode of the Stoic Handbook Podcast.